Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to another episode of New Books in History. I'm Stephen Colebrook. Today I'll be speaking with Graham Thompson, author of Herman Melville, Among the Magazines, published by University of Massachusetts Press in 2018. In this book, Thompson uses Melville's magazine work to examine broader questions about embedded authorship, the history of editing, and literary pilfering. In the end, Thompson asks, what did it mean to be a magazine writer in the 1850s? Graham, welcome to the programme.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you for inviting me on.
So could you just begin by giving a sort of overview of your own intellectual background and what brought you to this particular topic?
Well, I've been writing about Melville on and off, I guess, for the last, probably 20 years. And I wrote about Melville's very famous short story, Bartleby the Scrivener, first of all. When I first wrote about it 20 years ago, I wasn't really interested in the magazine context. In fact, I don't think when I first started writing about it, I even considered it as a magazine story at all. And I think going back to the story, that question of what difference did it make that it was a story published in a magazine started to interest me. And eventually, maybe about 8 to 10 years ago, I started to think more generally about Melville and this part of his career when he was writing exclusively for magazines and what difference it would make to our understanding of those stories, which critics really hadn't looked at before, if we thought about them, first of all, as magazine stories rather than just as stories. So that's the context of this particular project. I mean, my other work really has looked at American literature and culture during the 19th and the 20th century. So I've got quite kind of broad interests, I suppose. And I think it was the combination of a potential literary study to write more about Melville, but also to think about more of that general cultural context, I guess, which brings in the kind of interest in magazines. And to put these two things together seemed to me to be a potentially interesting project.
Great. So could you just give our listeners a quick overview of Melville's life in the 1850s?
Yes. So this was a period of, I guess, a great upheaval and change in all sorts of ways for Melville. So as we enter the 1850s, he's a relatively young man. He's 31 in 1850. And the 1850s is a decade when he becomes a father, when he writes that great novel, Moby Dick. When he moves to Pittsfield from New York City, so away from the kind of literary culture of New York and away to Western Massachusetts. So he relocates his whole life, effectively. And that's partly because he becomes slightly unhappy with the way that his writing career is developing and his relationships with people in New York City, certainly his kind of literary relationships in New York City. So he moves his whole life at the beginning of the 1850s. And during the decade, he obviously kind of suffers, I guess, literary rejection with Moby Dick and particularly with Pierre. He writes a novel which we know is now lost, The Isle of the Cross. He becomes a magazine writer during the mid-1850s, gives that up, goes traveling to Europe and the Middle East later on in the 1850s, comes back, becomes a traveling lecturer. So he goes on the lecture circuit, which was kind of popular thing for many people to do at the end of the 1850s. And then by the end of the decade, he almost gives up writing fiction completely and becomes a poetry writer. And really his kind of career, his public career as a writer, fades relatively quickly after that. So it's a period of great change in many ways for Melville. His 30s are kind of a turning point in his life.
Okay, great. So I just have a kind of a couple of more theoretical questions, particularly regarding your introduction. So how does your work engage with the concept of embedded authorship?
So I guess this is a phrase that I use to try and indicate Melville's position in the publishing system and a publishing network. But what I was interested in trying to do really was to think about the way that a writer is just kind of one cog in a system, clearly an important cog in that system. But publishing and certainly magazine publishing relied upon a lot of other activities as well, which go right from the beginning of that process, which is the paper making, which is something I deal with in the book, all the way through to that moment when whatever it is that's been produced is read by and consumed by a reader. So really, it's that kind of situatedness, I guess, of a writer in a publishing system. That's what I mean by embedded authorship. And I was interested to think about Melville's particular location in that kind of system. And I think the concept itself would allow us to deal with lots of other kinds of contingent possibilities where writers situate themselves. So it's very different from writer to writer. So some writers are kind of deeply embedded in a publishing system. Others are more shallowly embedded. And I think Melville is perhaps one of those writers. So he has particular connections with the paper industry, but he's not really part of that kind of publishing network that's going on in New York City, in which he really kind of removes himself from. Mm-hmm. And you can consider how that might be different for different kinds of writers, for Poe or for Hawthorne, for instance, or any writer in some ways. They are situated in a particular kind of a network or system. And using the concept like embedded authorship can help us to understand how a particular writer fits into whatever a system it is that they exist.
Mm. So a sort of follow-up question to that is, how did you balance historical context with the sort of formal literary qualities of Melville's work?
Well, I guess in a straightforward way, those two things are never separate. Mm-hmm. But I guess in broader terms, it's more of a kind of micro history, I guess, the book than a macro history. I think there's been a lot of work on Melville, obviously, and lots of very good work that situates him in a kind of broad historical context, and certainly an American context and a pre-Civil War context. I don't try to do that. I'm not particularly interested in those, or certainly not in this project, I'm not particularly interested in those broader kinds of historical readings of Melville's work. What I wanted to try and do was to create a kind of micro context, I guess, in which we can start to think in more detail about how those broader developments, so certainly the marketization of publishing and the print industry in the 19th century, how those broader developments play themselves out at a kind of a local level, if you like. And Melville is, so in many ways, he's a case study for that kind of work. And again, that connects to the idea of embedded authorship and how that can be very different for other authors, but it has a particular kind of resonance for somebody like Melville. So it's thinking about historical context in a contingent way, I guess, about how people's experiences of history are very different and they respond to it in different kinds of ways. And I guess thinking about the magazine context then brings in the kind of formal literary element, and to think about how that kind of micro or contingent historical context plays itself out in Melville's writing. You know, historical contexts have literary consequences. I think one important thing to consider for Melville is the way that form itself is an historical thing. So the kinds of literary qualities that I'm interested in Melville are themselves historical. So, you know, he's writing in magazines, he's writing particular kinds of pieces which do and don't fit in with the kinds of formal literary qualities that magazines are developing in the 1850s. So I guess it's that kind of micro context, thinking about what a single author study can do. And I think the one thing I was conscious of not trying to do was to try to make broad generalizations from a specific case study. So I didn't, it's not a book that's really about, that doesn't make claims about the publishing industry in general in the 1850s or about historical context more generally in the 1850s. It's really concerned with thinking about what it meant for Melville, what it looked like for Melville, what it felt like for Melville to be a writer in this particular moment, and how that comes across in the formal qualities of his work in these magazine stories.
Great. So your first chapter deals with the interactions between Melville and the paper industry, and your introduction has a fascinating anecdote about this. Could you describe that interaction for our listeners?
Yes. So when one of the results of Melville moving to Pittsfield in the early 1850s was that he moved, I don't think this was a conscious decision. It was connected with family context. So he ended up moving to Pittsfield in Western Massachusetts to a part of America that was one of the major papermaking regions of the country at that point. So the district in which he lived had many paper mills, and this was because of geography. So paper mills needed water to power them. So they were often built in more distant locations. So fortuitously, he ends up moving to this part of Massachusetts where paper is made. And as a writer, he obviously needs paper to work on. And clearly, when he's writing Moby Dick, he needs a lot of paper. So, you know, the anecdote I tell at the beginning of the story is about one trip that he takes in early 1851 to a local town, Dalton, which is near Pittsfield. He goes there on a sleigh with his family to basically buy paper on which he writes Moby Dick. So this is one sense in which he's an embedded author. He's embedded in this this paper economy. It's just on his doorstep, if you like. Mm-hmm. And this is obviously a very different relationship to that industry that somebody would have who lived perhaps, you know, in a city, who would buy their paper from a stationer or for rather than actually visiting a paper mill itself. And what you can see, not just in that particular anecdote, but in other ways, is how paper comes to inform Melville's kind of imagination. So he writes in the letter to Hawthorne at one stage that he has this dream of sitting in his house and having a paper mill at one end. And effectively what he describes is the paper being produced by this paper mill and flowing through his window. And he's writing on this continuous reel of paper as it comes off the paper mill. And so it becomes just part of his imagination, I guess. And more generally for a writer, particularly, you know, in the 19th century, paper is incredibly important, where you get it, how you source it, and how you use it. And people have written before about how Melville physically writes on paper and the way that he has a particular kind of physical relationship with paper. And I was just interested to explore that a bit further, I guess. And one of the things that he does following up from this trip to the paper mill, you know, he writes about it to the people that he knew in New York. So he famously writes on a letter to Everett Doiking that he's visited this paper mill, and he says what a great neighborhood it is for authors. And what he means is that I think what he's trying to say is that it's not just because there are other authors who live locally, famously Hawthorne, but other writers as well. But what he's really trying to to impress on Duyckinck is the fact that he lives in a part of the world where he can buy his own paper. That's what makes this a great neighbourhood for authors. So paper is very close to Melville's heart in many ways, very, very close to his life, very close to his sense of what it is to be a writer. And obviously, you know, writing is published eventually on paper in magazines or in books, but it first has to be written on paper. And I think it was that kind of relationship that Melville had with paper that I wanted to try and explore a little bit in these magazine stories.
Mm. So given the sort of effect on Melville's imagination that paper had, how does it function in his short stories?
Well, I think, first of all, it kind of offers a, even before it gets into the writing itself, it offers a kind of material support, I guess. It has a presence, it has a physical presence in Melville's working life. And I think what he's also aware of is that it also has a broader kind of social and economic function. So when he comes to write about it in his magazine stories, most evidently in Bartleby the Scrivener and The Paradise of Bachelors and The Tartarus of Maids, he's conscious of the way that paper works for other people apart from writers. So in Bartleby we have a lawyer for whom paper is very important, and certainly in the second part of The Paradise of Bachelors, we have somebody who sells and distributes seeds around the country in paper containers. So he's conscious of its place, not just as something that writers use, but something which other people in America are using at the time in which he's writing. So I think he's conscious or interested in trying to represent that relationship that other people have with paper as well. So it's a kind of multifunctional entity. The other, I think, thing that's important to say when it comes to writing is that it's a material form in which Melville not only plays out his ideas, but also it's something which offers him support. I guess what I mean by this is that it allows him to reaffirm himself as a writer. So there are lots of stories about Melville being an alienated writer in the 1850s. So the reception of Moby Dick is poor. The reception of Pierre is even worse. Mm-hmm. There is an idea that he somehow becomes alienated by this rejection in the 1850s. And that he takes this out, certainly in Bartleby the Scrivener, we see this sense of alienation played out in the Clerk. But I think I try to make the opposite argument in the book, that when he does come to write about it, we can read those stories as actually being an affirmation of his writing and his paper life, if you like. So it's somewhere where he's able to express himself. It has a positive sort of role in his life. Paper becomes a source of pleasure rather than a source of pain, I think. And I think those stories that he writes where paper is most evident tell that story. They tell the stories of people who are writing for certainly the lawyer in Bartleby. We often think about him as somebody just retelling this tale, but he's actually writing this story out. It becomes a moment of possibility for him to try and explain the strange experience he has with this scrivener. So it does become, and I think this is Melville's own experience, paper becomes a source of affirmation or pleasure, of possibility. He doesn't stop writing. No matter how badly he's rejected, he never stops writing. So he immediately picks up his pen and keeps writing. So pleasure, paper becomes a source of affirmation and pleasure, of possibility for him. And I think that's played out in the stories.
Mm. So moving on to your second chapter, which deals with the magazine industry during this period, could you just outline what the state of the industry was during the 1950s and also what genre conventions existed?
So it's a very volatile period. I think that's the thing to emphasise. It's a period of great expansion. So, you know, in the there'd been earlier phases of certainly of periodical expansion, certainly the newspapers in the 1830s and magazines too, but the 1850s marks another kind of stage in this expansion of the magazine industry. And what you find is that large publishers like Harper's and Putnam's, who Melville has written for, start to enter the magazine market. So once those large publishers get involved, you do get a sense that this is an industry where not only is there money to be made, but there are opportunities for development. So, you know, the print cultural environment, the commercial print cultural environment, does kind of take off in the 1850s, and magazines are an important part of that. So there's lots of expansion. You get more specialization. So this is, you know, one of the things that results from a growing market. That market starts to fragment in some ways, and you get specialized audiences. But it's also volatile in the sense that lots of magazines start and then finish. So Putnam's, one of the magazines that Melville writes for, it lasts for kind of 5 or 6 years, but that's it. Unlike Harper's, which, you know, starts in 1815, it's still going today. So there is an incredible amount of volatility here. You get magazines popping up and disappearing, one or two issues in some cases, you know, 2 or 3 years in other cases. So there's lots of kind of movement in the market. The forms that these magazines take are often kind of very miscellaneous. In some ways, they don't know what they're doing in the early stages of their development, so they try things out. So Harper's famously starts off as a magazine which really just reprints material from Britain and Europe, and only gradually kind of discovers or realizes that there's actually a market for homegrown writers. So it starts to publish American writers as well, and publishes original content, and Melville is part of that process. Other magazines like Putnam's pride themselves on publishing only American writers. But again, the forms that this writing takes is miscellaneous. So you get what we would now call short stories, although people didn't really kind of consider them in those terms then. But, you know, tales and sketches, essays are very important, reviews, illustration is starting to become very important. So certainly a magazine like Harper's prides itself on the quality of its illustrations. Putnam's couldn't really kind of keep up because it couldn't afford to illustrate in that way. So magazines are starting to become part of America's visual culture as well in the 1850s. And that visual dimension starts to change what magazines can do. And it changes the relationship between the written content and the visual content as well. Much of the material, certainly in Putnam's, is published anonymously. So people don't even know they're reading Melville during this time, and the same would apply to other writers as well. So in terms of genre, it's a very kind of very mixed environment. There are lots of different kind of forms competing with one another, and even within what we would now call a short story, there are lots of kinds of generic variety. So lots of sentimental fiction, which kind of ties in with the book publishing industry in the 1850s. But I guess the thing to say, and what's important for Melville, is that an expanding market allows people to not fly under the radar so much, but to kind of write in different kinds of ways, because the market's not fixed and people are still trying to work out what sells and what's viable. It means that they publish lots of different kinds of writing. And of course, they've got to fill the magazine every week or every month. So there are many more possibilities for writers in the 1850s, and genres aren't particularly fixed, I don't think. So it allows writers to move across and between genres, to merge genres. And I think, you know, this is something that Melville's very good at. He's aware of how genre works in magazines. He was a magazine reader himself, and so was his family. So he understands the conventions that are starting to kind of develop in the 1850s. But I think he also sees the possibilities in trying to cross or bring genres together. So Bartleby would be a very good example of this. You know, it's an example of a story which is about 1850s clerks in New York. It was quite a familiar genre. After all, many of the clerks would be reading these magazines and they wanted to read about people like themselves. So, you know, you can find other examples of stories about clerks in the 1850s, certainly in that urban environment. And that's what Bartleby does. That's what the story's about. But it's about something else as well. You know, there are lots of other things going on in that story. And so it brings in the genre of the city mystery, which is popular in the 1850s. It brings in that kind of psychological exploration that, you know, we'd started to see in Poe's writing, for instance. So there are lots of kind of opportunities to develop the short story in different kind of generic directions. And I think this is what Melville's trying to do in the 1850s, and why his writing is, I think, you know, distinctive and significant. So it's a very mixed landscape, a volatile industry, an expanding market with lots of kinds of possibilities and openings for writers to kind of do different kinds of things and to experiment and to explore the imaginative possibilities in the realms of magazine writing, whether that's in terms of essays or reviews or in terms of fiction.
Mm. So a slightly broader question, which is, what motivated Melville to write for magazines, given that he would be anonymous and he wouldn't get the credit that he would if he wrote a novel, for instance?
Well, that's the answer to that is very simple in one way, and the answer is money. So he wrote for money. The failure of his novels after really the kind of first couple, after Taipei and Omu, really meant that he couldn't sustain himself as a writer by writing novels. He relied upon his wife's income, family income, to keep his family, to support his family. And magazine writing actually paid very well in the 1850s. So certainly, you know, the big magazines like Harper's and Putnam's had quality thresholds. They wanted to publish quality material and they were prepared to pay for it. So the initial motivation was a financial one, and in some ways, you know, anonymity gave a writer protection, so you could actually get away with writing what you wanted to write, and perhaps things which were more commercially viable than perhaps you might want to put in a novel where your name would be emblazoned on the cover. And I think, again, going back to that issue of genre, if you look at the material that Melville wrote for Harper's, it was certainly kind of perhaps more amenable to a popular market than the material that he wrote for Putnam's, which was aimed at a different kind of market. So he was able to kind of move between these different markets and make money from both of them. It didn't always work. You know, some of his material was rejected, and he did only write for magazines for a short period of time, you know, for 3 or 4 years. So primary motivation was financial, but I guess there is a literary motivation here that we need to think about as well. Melville was the kind of writer who wasn't content just with churning things out for money. He was also, he never lost that kind of ambition to write what he wanted to write. You know, so that ambition, that literary ambition that you see in his transition from something like Taipei, a travel narrative, to, you know, a very ambitious novel like Moby Dick. He takes that with him. He takes that experience with him into the world of magazine stories. So that's why we see quite ambitious magazine stories in things like Benito Cereno and the Encantadas, kind of odd, experimental kinds of writing in some ways that he knew he could kind of get paid for as well, but which he also saw as opportunities to kind of carry on his literary ambitions. And I think, you know, this comes back to a larger kind of point about how his career develops and why he moves through different kinds of phases, I guess, in his writing, from popular novels to ambitious novels to magazine writing and then to poetry in his later life. this magazine moment, this period, is just kind of one moment in his career when he wants to explore literary possibility as well as writing for money. So the reason that he wrote for magazines was financial, but it was also a kind of different avenue, a different environment in which he could explore his literary ambitions. Mm.
So flipping that question around slightly, how did magazine editors respond to Melville's work, and what literary and aesthetic judgments did they bring to it?
I think in general, the magazine environment, the editing environment of the 1850s was quite conservative. And I mean, I think we overestimate how quickly literary tastes and traditions change often. They tend to change much more slowly. And the sorts of people who were editing magazines in the 1850s had quite conservative literary tastes, and their aesthetic judgments were relatively conservative as well. I mean, there was an awful lot of distinction going on here. So editors understood the difference between popular material and what they considered to be artful material, which were perhaps based on what we would now think are quite outdated criteria, quite traditional criteria. But you know, one of the oddities, I think, is to put Melville against some of these characters. So, and magazines themselves did this. So there's a famous instance in Putnam's, the very first, may have been the second edition of Putnam's magazine. There's an essay in there about Melville and another writer called George William Curtis. And it basically is a comparative study of their work. And Curtis is one of the editors, becomes one of the editors at Putnam's who assesses and judges Melville's writing. Now, looking back from our moment, they seem just incredibly different kinds of characters, and their writing careers and the writing they produce is incredibly, I think to our eyes, incredibly different. But people in the 1850s considered them to share a kind of a tradition in some ways. So I think that's the kind of environment in which Melville's writing, the kind of judgments that people were bringing to bear. They look very odd to us now, I think. But I think what that allows is Melville to be both popular and conformist in some ways, and to write in genres that people recognise, but also at the same time, I think, you know, as I said before, to kind of test out his literary ambitions. So whilst the writers at the time, or editors at the time, his work, you know, looked familiar and looked like other things they were publishing in their magazines, and quite conservative sorts of things in many ways. I think we can see now, with the benefit of hindsight, that Melville was also kind of trying to push the boundaries a little bit and to explore his literary kind of imagination in new directions. So in general, you know, magazines were relatively conservative, and this, I think, accounts for, you know, we can see those moments where his stories are rejected, for instance, the Two Temples. So Putnam rejects the Two Temples on the grounds that it might offend particular person in New York. And the story, I think, is quite explicit in referring to this this character, a religious minister, and so Putnam's is afraid of that, so they won't publish. So there are those kinds of local concerns. There's another story of Melville's that Curtis, the Bell Tower, that Curtis has mixed feelings about. He rejects it initially because it doesn't do what he thinks a good story should do for Putnam's, and then he changes his mind the kind of next day, and he starts to see qualities in it that may. He kind of recognizes, and then chooses to publish the story. So it's a kind of odd environment, you know. The other thing to consider is that, of course, editors have got to fill an issue of their magazine. They've got to find the content, because if they don't find the content, they've got to write it themselves effectively, which is what a lot of editors did when they had a gap. So, you know, that affects your judgment It's not entirely a kind of literary or an aesthetic judgment. There are kind of practical mm-hmm. considerations here. Have we got enough material to fill the next issue? And the other consideration for editors is that they're dealing with lots of authors in each issue of a magazine. It's not like a novel where you may have a particular relationship with an editor or a publisher. You know, editors of magazines are dealing with dozens, perhaps even hundreds of authors at a time. So you don't have that kind of one-to-one relationship. You send material in. This is what Melville did. He just sent material into these magazines, and you have to, you know, wait for their judgment. They say yes or no. Mostly they said yes to Melville, but I don't think it's always a case of them loving the stories that he wrote. It's a case of them thinking, okay, yeah, these stories are okay. They're fine. There may be particular things about them we don't like, but actually the next issue or the issue after that, we've got a gap we need to fill. We can afford to do it. The story's not too long. We can always serialize it if we need to. You know, those kinds of practical considerations are just as important, I think, as the aesthetic judgments that are passed on Melville's stories. Mm.
So moving on to your fourth chapter, how does reading these magazines in their entirety change our understanding of Melville's writing?
I think one of the things you realise when you start to read even the individual issues in which Melville's stories were published is the sheer volume of material that was being produced in the 1850s. This is becoming a mass industry. So there's just an awful lot of material. Now, what that does is to make Melville's stories pieces of ephemera in many ways. You know, they don't stand out in terms of, and even for magazine writers at the time, Melville wrote relatively little. You know, he only wrote a very few number of stories amongst this kind of mass of material. And so it's very easy for an individual item in one issue to, you know, to disappear in many ways or to not be significant. So I think, you know, reading the magazines themselves in which these stories appear gives you a sense of the broader kind of literary and cultural context in which Melville is just kind of one, I guess, speck in. I think you also get a better sense of the cultural preoccupations of the magazines. So you see the kinds of materials or the other books that they're reviewing, for instance. You get a sense of what other fiction people are writing. You get a sense of how a magazine prioritizes its material. So where do the stories appear? Do they become at the beginning? Are they the most important thing in the magazine? Are they illustrated? You know, all sorts of questions like that. The kind of paratextual environment, I guess, in which they exist. But I think one of the other key things that you get from reading the magazines themselves is you get a sense in which Melville is connected and has similar interests to other writers who are writing in magazines at the time. So you see crossovers between the material that he's writing about, whether it's race in Benito Cereno or Clarks in Bartleby the Scrivener, and other material, which may not be written in fiction, but maybe, you know, the subject of an essay and a review. Melville's is connected to this other material. His stories are connected to this other material as well. And you can start to make links and start to see how Melville kind of fits in or diverges from other kinds of opinions that are being expressed in these magazines.
Mm. So your fifth chapter deals with the topic of literary pilfering, and Melville famously relied on other literary sources. How does his magazine writing change our understanding of this practice, and what does this tell us about magazine writing more generally in the 1850s?
Well, I mean, a short answer to that would be I don't know, because I'm not sure how common this practice was. So it was clearly important to Melville. So Bartleby the Scrivener, for instance, we know it shares similarities with a story that was published in in another periodical in the 1850s. So it begins in pretty much exactly the same way. We're introduced to this kind of scrivener in that other story. And Melville kind of obviously copies this. He then writes a very different kind of story. Benito Cereno is a version of events written in a non-fiction way by a former sea captain. And Israel Potter, the same, is based upon another book that was published much earlier. Now, Melville shows himself to be a great editor. He edits these stories effectively and rewrites these stories. But I'm not sure how common that is. And this goes back to the question about magazines more generally in the 1850s. The sheer volume of material means that it's actually very difficult, I imagine, to track down the nature of this practice, certainly with our current methods of close reading and author-based studies. You know, without very clear clues from the writers themselves about, or from kind of that kind of literary archaeology and digging up these kinds of connections, it's difficult to know how common this practice was. I mean, it may be that we, in future years, we come to know much more about the prevalence of these activities and this kind of rewriting process. I mean, it may be that different kinds of methods, quantitative methods in literary analysis, might help us to dig up other examples of where this works. And certainly, you know, we know a lot about reprinting and how material is reprinted in periodicals in the 1850s. And sometimes it's changed or altered but not in particularly significant ways. You know, Melville clearly rewrites entirely these earlier stories. So I don't know how prevalent it was. I don't know what it tells us about magazines in the 1850s. It's not always clear to me precisely whether the magazines who were publishing these stories were even aware that they were based upon previous narratives. I mean, it's not entirely clear to me whether people would have been aware that Benito Cereno was based upon the recollections of a former sea captain. I mean, you know, this the nonfiction that it was based on, the book that it was based on, was published, you know, over 30 years before Melville wrote this story. So those kinds of questions we don't know, and it may be that they just thought this was an original story and not a kind of pilfered story. But I guess that, you know, the larger point is that literary pilfering, as I call it, or literary borrowing, you know, we know that takes place, and the questions about issues of plagiarism are quite a hot topic in other kind of literary traditions, certainly kind of the Romantics in Britain, and this idea of what an author was. You know, should an author be somebody who just invented from nothing? That's an idea of authorship that only develops, I think, in the 19th century. So, you know, there are those broader questions about literary borrowing. But as to magazines themselves, it may be that lots of writers were pilfering other stories and rewriting them for magazines, but that we just as yet don't know about them. You know, there are opportunities to try and kind of to follow up there and do further study on that.
Sounds like a question that some future digital humanities technique might help with. Just a final kind of broader question, which is, what are the implications of your work for how scholars conceptualize Melville's career as a whole? And I'm thinking in particular about the issue of why he fell into obscurity.
Yes, I mean the question of obscurity is a good one to think about. So there is a familiar narrative about Melville, which is that his career is an inverted climax, as I think somebody referred to it. So he starts off with a bang, you know, with Typee, which is very successful, and then gradually his career declines, and certainly, you know, with those large, difficult novels like Mardy, and then with Moby Dick and Pierre and The Confidence Man. Magazines are a moment, actually, which, you know, are difficult to fit into that narrative, because it could be that actually many more people were reading his work at that moment than had ever read his work. I mean, Harper's had a circulation of 200,000 people. So those stories that he wrote for Harper's could have been read by many more people than wrote his novels. But I think, yes, in general, that's how we think about Melville's career. But of course, the thing we have to consider is that literary fame was a very different beast in the 19th century. Certainly in America, there were very few writers who were continuously successful or popular. Writing was a career which was very hit and miss. It's very difficult to sustain oneself through writing and therefore to have a continuous writing career. Many writers were successful for a moment and then stopped writing or did something else. And I think that's a better way in which to think about Melville. You know, he wasn't always a writer. It's not evident that he always had ambitions to be a writer. He becomes a writer at a certain moment in his life. In the 1840s and in the 1850s, and he explores various kinds of ways of writing, novels, and then magazine writing, and then really stops being a writer, certainly being a published writer, turns to poetry, becomes a customs official, and then, you know, lives out his life. So obscurity is the right word in some ways. His literary fame fades, but I'm not sure obscurity is the right word in another way, because it kind of misconceives, I think, what writing is and was and what authorship was in the 19th century and certainly in the 1840s and 50s. So he's just somebody who writes for a while and then does something else. I think that's a better way to think about his career, but also to think about his literary career as one in which he kind of explores different forms of writing. So you see him start off as a kind of really not a novelist so much as a travel writer, and that's how Typee is sold, as a travel narrative. We think about it now as a novel because we know it's fiction. And he writes and he develops the novel form through Moby Dick. Then he turns to writing magazine stories, short stories, then stops writing those and starts becoming interested in writing poetry. So that's a better way, I think, to think about Melville's career, that he just writes different things at different points in his life. And I think that is something that people have started to think about. So they pay much more attention now to the poetry that he wrote and to the things that he wrote, certainly like Billy Budd towards the end of his life and his writing career. So I don't think, you know, Melville was never really a kind of professional writer. And he was never a jobbing writer. He wrote at certain moments in certain ways and did other things and survived through all the means, certainly with the help of his wife's family money.
So in many respects, the idea of obscurity imposes on his life our ideas of how writers should behave.
Yeah, and I think almost inevitably, we think about writers from a kind of contemporary perspective. We think about what it is to be a writer today, and we certainly are a little bit obsessed perhaps with the rewards that writing and popular writing can bring. So we think about, those very successful writers of the 20th century and 21st century who do sustain a career through writing. But even now, I mean, even today, you know, if you look at those reports that the Writers Guild in the US published, for instance, you know, most people who write don't make money from writing. There are lots of different ways to write and to publish now, certainly with kind of digital opportunities. But, you know, writing and making money and having a career have always and continue to be quite precarious, I think. So I don't think we should think too much about writing in terms of a financial career or sustaining one's financial life. Writing is much more about a kind of imaginative process that people pick up and put down as they go through their lives.
Great. Well, thank you for being on the programme today, Graham. That was a fascinating conversation. I just have one final question for you, which is, what are you working on now?
So now, I guess this follows on from the work on Melville, is to think more about magazines, but to think more about that general 19th century context of how magazines were made and how literature was made. And what I mean by made is literally made. So how was literature more generally, and this could include magazines, but books, pamphlets, poetry, all sorts of things. How was it made? What processes had to be in place for that material to actually reach its audience? So the project more generally is called Making American Literature, and it really kind of asks three key questions. You know, how was literature made in the 19th century? How was it, where did the paper come from? How was it produced? How did printing work? All those kinds of questions about the physical infrastructure. You know, what sorts of things did people read in the 19th century, apart from books and magazines, all those other kinds of material? And how did this material reach its readers? I mean, I think that's a question we need to know more about. How was it circulated and distributed? Where did you buy a novel in the 19th century? You know, we know how to do it today, but what's the history of the bookstore, for instance, in the 19th century? So the project more generally is about those kinds of questions about the infrastructure in which literature was produced and distributed, even before it, you know, that what I'm interested in is that moment before it gets read, if you like. I'm interested in that pre-reading stage.
Well, that sounds absolutely fascinating, and I very much look forward to reading the results of that research. Thanks again for being on the program today, Graham.
Thanks, Steve.